Dr. Rock's radio show, Thursday, 8 p.m. on peoplesinternetradio.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome, one and all, to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Give that a bit more volume, sounds better. Thanks very much to Nick Nomic for kicking on in there for the last couple of hours. Great tunes, good to see so many of you in the chat box. We kicked off, of course, with I'm the Doctor, which of course I'm not, though I do claim to be occasionally. Motorhead, Speed of the Sound of Loneliness from the Alabama 3, one of the great favourites. And then Problem Child, because I sometimes think that I am one. Well, hopefully you should have an interesting show lined up for tonight. Some of you will have heard a couple of weeks or so back, I was looking with Cotty at the guide notes for a thing called One Planet, the One Planet Development Planning Policy, which exists in Wales but not in England. And we were looking at it with something of a critical eye because it's full of requirements which look to me to be extremely demanding when we know, you know, how the system works, and that it basically is after control and money. That's fundamentally what policy seems to be about. And to me, on first reading, this OPD guideline looked exactly like that, an instrument of control and money making, really. And it is important because, as we found out at the public inquiry we went to last year, such guide notes, if you actually find yourself in a judicial position where enforcement action is being taken, it would appear that the professional witnesses and the barristers and all of that, they refer to these guide notes as if they were, you know, some kind of law written in blood. So it's kind of serious stuff. However, there's another important aspect to think of One Planet Development, and that is that it is actually enabling people to get out onto the land, growing food and working together to produce primary products, food, fuel and fibre, fundamentally. It's also enabling people to build the kind of houses that they want to build. Now, again, obviously you can't quite build anything you want. It seems that it's easier to do it if you stay within certain levels of building regs, but these are seriously alternative kind of dwellings, really beautiful looking places. Most of all, I think it's getting people so that they can live and work in proximity with each other in the countryside, because one of the real problems we seem to have is that slowly but surely people are moving further and further away from each other. Farms are getting bigger and bigger, which means it's harder and harder to do things, shall we say, like bartering and exchanging and that kind of thing. Now, currently there are, I think, well, last time I looked, there were 4 One Planet Development that had been approved and are swinging along quite nicely. And that is the aspect of it, really, that I'd like to look at tonight. So very shortly, I'll be putting on another couple of tunes whilst I phone up Tao Winbush, who is one of the members of the Lammas community over in Pembrokeshire, I think it is, where they have managed to establish 9 roughly 6-acre small holdings, so it's about 45 acres in all. And they've been there about 6 years, so it's pretty well established now. And I want to talk to Tao about what it's like being there, really. Since it was established, there's another 9 small holdings appearing around the original 9, which I think is a really good sign. It means that it is at least, as far as some people are concerned, a workable model. And, you know, Tao's pretty upbeat about it, although I know that he has had reservations in the past. So we'll be talking with him about Lammas, about what it's like living there and what it's like actually on the ground dealing with One Planet Development policies. Because while some of us might hesitate, obviously to a lot of other people it is an extremely attractive option, and it does seem to be working. So Tao will be talking to us about that for an hour or so, I expect. And then a bit later in the show, I'm going to chat with another chap who's really interested in OPD, but he's in England where they don't have this policy. He's a man called Pete the Hat, and he's helping out on the One Planet Council, which was, as far as I understand it, is a council that has been set up to help people steer their way through this policy. And I'm hoping also that it's going to turn out to be an organisation or a group of people that can perhaps help to steer the policy as well, because it does, in my opinion, need to be modified a bit. But he's a very enthusiastic character. We're talking to him about that and a bit about Lammas as well. And he also runs a website called Grow Your Own Home, which I shall post a link to whilst I'm playing the next tunes, because there's some really beautiful homes in there. And one of the things I think Pete's looking to do is to encourage kind of a cross-border cooperation, as it were, between people in England and people in Cymru who are running these sort of projects and other low-impact, land-based projects, in the hope that, obviously, the more cooperation there can be, the easier it's going to be for everybody. So I think Tao will be about ready to be called up now, so I'm going to put on a couple of short tunes. We'll kick off with the English beat and Click Click. It's just a little one. Another one after that, and then I'll be back with you, hopefully, with Tao in tow. I'll see you very shortly. There we go. Billy Idol and Rebel Yell there. And I'm now joined on the line by Tao Wimbush, as predicted. Hi there, Tao. Welcome to Dr. Rock's radio show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you very much for agreeing to come and join us on People's Internet Radio. It's really great to have you there. And I think to talk about a very exciting project, obviously, because I'd like to do it myself. So can you tell us a bit, just give us a bit of an idea of how it was you got involved with Lammas to start with, and whether there was a One Planet development policy then or it was something different?
Okay, well, I got involved with the Lammas eco-village right at its conception. And let me just fill in a bit of background. I've lived in kind of alternative communities virtually all my adult life, starting at Deepy Valley and then Bristy Mawr and then Holtsfield, all in West Wales. And myself, along with a group of other people, first of all, we decided that there needed to be a viable route whereby people could move from a mainstream lifestyle to an alternative lifestyle. And we took advantage of a lucky break in the Welsh planning system. There was a local policy in Pembrokeshire which legitimised low-impact development. And the group of us, we took advantage of that, and we decided to create a flagship project. Hence the concept of Lammas was born. We wanted to get this eco-village through the planning system and demonstrate not only that it's totally possible for human beings to live in balance with the ecology, it's also possible to live productively on kind of small-scale small holdings, and it's totally possible to transition from a mainstream lifestyle to an alternative lifestyle. And here we are now. We've been living here on the ground just over 6 years, and it's really successful. You know, we're doing it. It's totally viable.
So how many people were there in that core team?
In the core team, there were five of us to begin with.
Wow.
And, yeah, I'm not... Yeah, I'm the last man standing.
Are you? The rest of them have moved on. Have they moved on to other similar... Or have they gone to live in high-rises in Birmingham?
Oh, no, they're all kind of still involved in the alternative movement.
Yeah, I'll bet. So how quickly did it, because you've now got nine households there, how quickly did that kind of develop around you?
Well, first of all, it took us quite a few years to navigate the planning system. It took us about 3 years, partly because it was a very innovative policy, it had never been done before, partly because it was a big, complex application, and partly as well, we were pretty naive about our approach to the planning system. We'd never done it before, and we made some mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so 3 years in 2009, we got planning permission for nine households. And virtually all of us moved on within 6 months. And so the original kind of planning permission has got the nine households, and then around us, we've got a whole load of peripheral activity. And people often ask me, okay, how many people live in the eco-village? It's a difficult question to answer because there's no longer a clear line that defines where the eco-village begins and where the eco-village ends, because we're surrounded by a whole series of peripheral plots, people living in rented accommodation who've come to live here because of the kind of scene going on. But as a general estimate, to give you an idea, I would say that there's something like 50 adults here at the eco-village, and then, I don't know, 30 kids on top of that.
Mm-hmm. And presumably you get to work together, quite closely, at least some of you with others, I suppose, not all of you, perhaps.
Well, in essence, the way that eco-village is set up is it's a collective of small holdings. And so on each small holding, people are free to live as communal or as isolated lifestyles as they choose. I mean, that's one of the kind of foundations of the Lammas Project, is that there's a lot of social freedom. And so, you know, the kind of social patterns vary quite widely from plot to plot, as does just so many things, you know, because we've got kind of vegetarians here, we've got meat eaters here, we've got people who are approaching it from a kind of permaculture perspective, people who are approaching it from a more conventional horticultural perspective. And so, and that's kind of part of the beauty of the project, is that we are able to demonstrate a whole kind of mosaic of different approaches. We've got timber-framed buildings, earth-sheltered buildings, round houses, square houses, all sorts. So, you know, we celebrate the diversity that the project is.
It must make for tremendous opportunities for learning from each other.
Well, the whole thing is a massive learning experience. I mean, you uproot from, you know, a mainstream lifestyle and go and pitch up your life in a kind of field in North Pembrokeshire with no services, you know, and then fast forward 6 years on, you know, we've got electricity, we've got running water, we've got good tracks, good footpaths, we've got dwellings, we've got livelihoods, we've got income streams, waste management systems. You know, yeah, it's been steep learning curves for us all, I think.
Mm-hmm. But you've all had to be involved with all of that stuff, with the actual water, with the power, with the waste disposal. There's sort of none of it's left to somebody else's responsibility.
Yeah, and that's part of the kind of magic of the place, you know. I mean, I grew up in a fairly conventional household. When I turned on the switch, I didn't know where that electric came from. When I flushed the sink or the toilet, I didn't know where that went. Whereas here in this lifestyle, you're kind of required to take responsibility for your water sources, your waste processing, your electrical sources, and that is an incredibly empowering process to go through.
And it must be to a certain extent easier for these new people that are turning up to try and do it to have that foundation of experience upon which to build. It presumably saves a lot of money and mistakes in the long run.
Well, I think that the movement, the One Planet or the Low Impact movement here in West Wales, is certainly growing in strength and wisdom and resilience. And yeah, I like to think that the courses and the experience that we offer here does give people a really good stepping stone, so that, you know, because more and more of these applications go through, more and more people are doing it. So for them, they're learning, I hope, from our wisdom, and it's a bit easier for them.
Mm. I must admit, some of the planning officers seem to want to learn and be sympathetic to this, which is really cool.
Definitely, there are some brilliant planning officers, there's some very forward-thinking planning officers, but it's kind of all sorts. I mean, it's, you know, culturally it's quite a big thing in terms of planning, because, I mean, the planning system, the whole basis of the planning system is the Town and Country Planning Act, which says basically the towns are where people live and the countryside is reserved solely for agriculture.
Yeah.
And so the One Planet policy is a unique departure from this, which says, okay, yeah, you can build your dream house in the open countryside so long as you are living sustainably, being productive with the land, and building from local natural materials. And that's a real departure from the kind of conventional planning perspective.
Yes, I should imagine that you're having to break a few habits in the planning office to do that. Are they finding that easy, do you think?
It varies a lot. From department to department and from officer to officer. And, you know, we're making progress. There's no doubt about that. Generally, these days, the planning officers are pretty good. You know, they see the policy, they appreciate what it's there to do. It is complex, but, you know, they can see the wisdom behind it. And generally, if you put in a good application, applicants are winning the support of the planning officers. Mm. They're having a little more trouble with the elected councillors, representatives that often sit on those kind of planning committees, who, at the risk of overgeneralizing, tend to be a little bit more conservative in their outlook and a little bit harder to persuade that there are alternative ways of approaching lifestyle and land productivity.
Yeah. Though I think, as far as I can gather, Lammas has gone down as a holy good thing, pretty much, amongst the local, the sort of, what should we call them, the indigenous population, for want of a better word.
Well, yeah, and that in itself has been quite a big turnaround. When our application went in, there was, you know, quite large local opposition, even, you know, overwhelming in some sectors of the community. And it took us a few years to kind of turn that round, but just by kind of an attitude of transparency and hard work and kind of openness,
yeah,
I reckon we have wholly run around, turned around.
It is vital. Yeah, it's vitally important to do that, isn't it, to get on with the locals?
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's like I said, you know, from our perspective, our boundaries are very blurred, you know. Our kids all go to the local schools, we all participate in local clubs, we run a lot of social scenes here at the Eco Village, which, you know, are virtually all open. I think there has been a big turnaround in perspective. What was seen as a kind of threatening bunch of eco-warriors is now seen as sort of a kind of really well-intentioned, successful, kind of pioneering project. Yeah,
absolutely great. I mean, that's no small achievement in itself, overcoming people's prejudices, which is basically what they are, I think. So what was there when you arrived? What did you start with?
So 6 years ago, there was 76 acres of degraded pasture and neglected woodland. You could walk across the land. There were no flowers, there were no insects, there was virtually no bird life. It was just, you know, totally flat, overgrazed fields, nothing there. It had been continuously grazed the entire piece of land for 25 years, overgrazed by sheep. So, you know, that was the kind of context at which we arrived. And here we are, 6 or so years later, and it is a complete turnaround. The place is absolutely humming with wildlife, bees, flowers, diversity. The kind of ecological turnaround that we've been able to facilitate is absolutely remarkable, to the point now where, you know, we're seeing kind of some of the larger mammals and kind of upper predators coming in. We've just, for the first time this year, we've seen goshawks. There's goshawks around the site, you know, otters, hedgehogs, polecats, you know, on and on. These are now becoming commonplace, whereas when we arrived, it was really, you know, environmentally heavily degraded.
That's brilliant, isn't it? It's brilliant partly because we're talking 6 years, you know, guys, 6 years. That's such a short time to pull about that kind of transformation.
It's really heartening, and good for the soul as well. You know, that's one of the kind of really rewarding things about being here, is witnessing that kind of total transformation. And just really encouraging that human beings can turn, you know, quite a windswept, desolate hillside into something that is so diverse now. Yeah?
I think it's what we're here to do. I believe we're here to garden and achieve this sort of effect. And the other thing is that the kind of the scale of increase in wildlife and all of that, considering you're working on 75 acres, which is actually quite a small patch, is, I think, also very impressive. And, of course, it provides a battery for these creatures to live in and move elsewhere from.
Definitely. We're lucky in that we're positioned next to a kind of wooded valley. that's you know, given us a head start. And also, you know, there's, like I said at the beginning, there's a lot of peripheral activity, you know, not just immediately on our kind of doorstep, but in the locality. You know, I would, you know, roughly off the top of my head, I would say there's at least another 120 acres in the locality, which since our arrival has been kind of is under transformation from farmland to a kind of what I would refer to as permaculture land, or certainly a diverse ecology, either as One Planet Holdings or small holdings or, you know, conservation type projects.
Yeah, and all of this, of course, planted in what will basically just be acres and acres of improved grassland.
Yep.
Absolutely fantastic, I think. So you kicked off with a kind of a sort of local version of OPD. Where did One Planet Development come from?
Well, it's a kind of next step on from low impact development, which was pioneered by Simon Fairy and the kind of land-based communities in England. That then kind of, there was some research commissioned by the Welsh Government that came up with some kind of very interesting results. The Welsh Government, as part of their commitment to sustainability, encouraged this pioneering local policy in Pembrokeshire. And then, you know, shortly after we got planning permission, it was scaled up to a national level, and it was kind of framed as One Planet Development, partly because the Welsh Government has a commitment that Wales as a nation will become a One Planet nation within a generation. And that is a massive commitment. As far as I'm aware, that's probably the most ambitious kind of ecological, environmental, sustainable commitment of any government. I mean, it's absolutely massive, and absolute credit to them.
And strictly speaking, if they're going to do that, they're going to need to learn from people like you and then start encouraging other people to do the same if the whole nation is going to come to, what, 1.88 global hectares per person or whatever it is.
Yeah, and in a way, that's what the One Planet Development Policy is designed to do. It's designed to create exemplars of sustainable living all around the country. Mm. And that is starting to happen. We have One Planet Developments in Caerphilly, you know, all across West Wales. There are applications now up in North Wales and Mid Wales, in Monmouth. You know, it is coming.
I know we've had, last time I looked, we'd had four, maybe five approvals. There was the kind of four originals and one since then. How many are through, do you know?
It's something like that. Half a dozen have gone through. There's probably something like between six or eight in the pipeline. Mm. Some of those are multiple unit applications.
Because they did have a short stint where they seemed to be pushing everybody to appeal, didn't they? There was Tom O'Kane's bit, Nanticum, Corner Wood, which I know caused you some disturbance because that went to two appeals and failed, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, it is undoubtedly a learning curve, both on the part of the planners and on part of the applicants.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting that we're having this kind of conversation today because I think it's on Saturday, the One Planet Council are running a training day for applicants and planners to kind of, to educate as to the kind of complexities and best approach to the planning application. So, yeah, there have been kind of, there's been a learning curve, if you like, on both sides about how to use the policy. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, to a degree, there is an element of chance in the planning system. Cornerwood, for example, you know, who I've got total admiration for the Cornerwood project. From my perspective, one of the best OPD applications there's been. But, you know, just through a whole series of bad luck, perhaps a bit of prejudice mixed in there, haven't been able to get through the One Planet policy. And they're still there, and I hope that in time we will be able to get them through.
Oh, that's great. So they managed to escape the enforcement action then?
I'm hoping that the Caledonian, in their wisdom, have just kind of like decided to just kind of hands off a bit and give them a bit of space.
Great.
There certainly hasn't been any enforcement action to date, thankfully. And, you know, like I said, credit to the residents of Cornwood. They're still there working away in the woodland, producing chairs, all sorts of furniture, all sorts of wooden craft. They've run a very busy kind of summer schedule, doing all the local craft fairs, running workshops for kids and adults alike in pole lathing, spoon making, all this kind of stuff. And they're still there doing their thing, living their low impact lifestyles. So all being well, that situation will resolve itself in time.
That's great, because one of the things that when I saw, because what actually happened to them, as far as I can gather, this was from the letter that you wrote to the Welsh planning authorities on the subject. They had an appeal on three grounds, which they addressed and kind of completely redid their business plan and all that, and totally addressed the things that they were supposed to. And then what happened was the planning authority came back with five completely different requirements to place on them. And this is one of the things that I was a bit concerned about with local authorities and stuff, is that they might keep moving the goalposts around, which they obviously were then. Is that still the same case, or are things a bit more stable now?
Okay, so I think to start off with, the Cornwood project started before the OPD policy came through. You're quite right, their initial application was turned down and then went to appeal, and there was a list of kind of reasons for refusal. They went away, rewrote their application, that then went to appeal, and then it was turned down on different grounds. And that actually happened a third time. So, yeah, it certainly felt like there was moving of goalposts, but that wasn't the local authority. That was more actual just different planning inspectors coming at it with different perspectives.
I see, yeah.
In my experience, planning officers, to their credit, are generally a bit more consistent. And is there less moving of the goalposts around? I think so. I hope so. You know, only time will tell.
Yeah.
Certainly the calibre of applications that is in at the moment is much higher than it used to be. Like I said, that's our learning curve. And in my experience, the responses from planning officers are generally better informed, more professional in terms of their appreciation and understanding of the policy, and, you know, certainly the concepts behind it, which to a planning officer, in many cases, are pretty unfamiliar. I mean, bear in mind, I mean, look at it from a planner's perspective, yeah? Generally, you'll be working in a council department, you'll be under-resourced, overstretched, trying to process however many applications you've got to process a day, and then an OPD application arrives on your desk. You know, generally, a management plan is something like 80 pages, can go up to 200, 300 pages in some cases. Generally, there'll be, you know, I don't know, a dozen appendices. Even the policy guidance itself is 70 pages long.
Yes.
You know, and so it's like, whoa, that's a massive workload to land on the planner's desk. And then when you go into the planning guidance, you're talking about concepts that many planning officers won't have had any experience of up until now. You know, you're talking about permaculture, off-grid living, you know, a completely different approach to productivity, and biodiversity and lifestyle. And so, you know, it's been a tough call for the planning officers whose desks this policy, these applications have landed on. You know, and, you know, from my perspective, the kind of attitudes that we're getting from the planning officers are really pretty good these days.
I guess there's going to be a cadre of planning officers who choose perhaps to specialise in this. Mm. And the thing is, as you say, all the county councils are cutting departments. Clearly, as they get more and more of these, it's going to be a bit more of a challenge for them. Are they showing keen and willing to come to your courses to come to the council's courses on these things?
Yeah, some more than others. You know, and it, in a way, once you've dealt with one of these applications, once you've got your head around the concepts and the structure, the next one's much easier. And so, yes, that is kind of happening. What you're getting is, I mean, particularly out here in West Wales, you know, Pembrokeshire County Council have dealt with probably, I don't know, you know, half a dozen or so of these types of applications. They're pretty familiar with them now. They understand them. They've got a few planning officers who can comfortably deal with an OPD application. Similar Pembrokeshire Coast National Park, similar Carmarthenshire. You know, they're all coming to terms with it. For the kind of like, you know, the unusual ones, Conwy Council have just had one land on their desk. You know, that's going to be like, when you've got an application in a county which hasn't experienced this before, that's when there's a kind of sharp learning curve. And, generally there's a good response to kind of skilling up, although the budget cuts make that difficult.
Yeah, you know? Yes, I can see there being a bit of a difficulty there, although that might well be in the long run in our interest, mm-hmm. because it'll mean that it has to be made a little bit simpler if it's going to succeed.
Well, I think over time it will be made simpler, but it's kind of still in its proving itself.
Yeah.
I mean, Lammas is an eco-village. You know, we've proven ourselves. You know, we've tested the concept. Yes, the concept works. Yes, a group of people can go on. They can turn a piece of farmland round, make it incredibly productive, incredibly diverse. Yeah, we've proved it. But that needs kind of replicating around the country. But yeah, I can see that in, you know, 5-10 years or so, that there'll be a revision of the practice guidance for one planet developments that hopefully will simplify things, both for planners and for applicants. But to a degree, it's like there's a sort of trust issue. So coming back to the planning officer, so generally planning officers have to deal with quite a lot of applications of people trying to build in the open countryside, people trying to buy their cheap bit of farmland and build their house. It's totally understandable that people try and do that because, you know, the right to live somewhere in the UK is worth something in the region of 50 to 100 grand.
Yeah.
Because it's a kind of controlled market, in a sense. You know, you can buy a fifth of an acre plot in a town, you're talking, or just like a small plot to build a house in a town, you're talking 120, 130 grand, similar sized plot out in the countryside, it's going to be, you know, £2,000.
Mm.
You know, so the right to live there costs quite a lot of money. So, you know, planning officers get a lot of applications of people trying to build their bungalow, either covertly or openly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a trust issue. You know, is One Planet Development viable? You know, the hurdle is the bar for applications is deliberately high because it kind of needs to prove itself as a kind of concept and a movement.
I've been thinking about that as well. I think that the amount of commitment and the different skills that are going to be needed to kind of pull this off, I can sort of understand that actually the demands being made by this planning system force you to focus your mind and see whether you are going to be able to do it or not, because it's not a thing to be undertaken lightly.
Definitely. And in a way, the planning process is really quite good in that regard. So a One Planet application, you buy 5 acres of farmland and you decide, okay, me and my family are going to move there, we're going to build our straw bale tower, and we are going to grow mushrooms, which are going to sell to the local cafes, and we're going to have a polytunnel full of strawberries, and we're going to have a little goat scene to provide us with milk, etc., etc., etc. So in order to kind of turn that into an application, you have to write quite an in-depth management plan, which covers all the aspects of your lifestyle. You know, you've got to kind of plan for how you're going to build your building, where you're going to get your fuel from, where you're going to get your electric from, where you're going to source your water, how can you make sure all these things are sustainable, etc., etc., etc. So it requires a kind of a real kind of diligence, and it's a real kind of preparatory experience. if approached with the right attitude, writing a management plan gives you the kind of basis and the understanding and the kind of, what is it, the step up that you need in order to make this transition from a mainstream lifestyle where all these services are provided for you to this alternative lifestyle where you're going to create an entirely new infrastructure for your family's household from scratch.
Yeah.
So, and it's a really, in that regard, it's a really good process, because the truth is, once you hit the ground, once you've got your planning permission, and you then you move on to your field and your caravans, you haven't got time to research what rootstock your apple trees are going to be on, what logs you're going to inoculate in order to do your mushroom farm, etc., etc., etc. So that kind of research kind of period is a really important preparatory step for what is, you know, an ambitious and equally rewarding lifestyle change.
Yeah, have you found, have there been any people who've tried it and just shook their heads and gone back to town?
You know what, Doctor? That's one thing that hasn't happened, which is remarkable, really.
It is.
You know, there hasn't been a single household, either at Lammas or in any of the OPD, or low impact applications here in West Wales, that has given up and gone back to the mainstream lifestyle. Mm. Not one.
Well, you see, that's one of the things that that certainly seems to demonstrate to me that OPD is actually a lot more friendly than it looks in theory, if nobody's actually given it up, because it is demanding. I think that's really grand. And have you got any idea in your head roughly how much people do need? How much did people need, say, to come and set themselves up at Lammas? I know that's probably quite a difficult number.
Well, no, not really. I mean, as a general rule, you know, if you're a single person household, I would say to set yourself up as an OPD, you really need something like access to about £30,000 to set yourself up. And if you're a family, I would double it.
Yeah.
Like access to about £60,000. And that is still a lot of money. You know, but that is the reality, because you've got to purchase the holding. You know, land at the moment in West Wales is going for something like £6,000-£7,000 an acre. You know, you will need roughly, you know, let's say 5 acres for a household.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you've got your initial land price. The planning process is going to cost you a few grand, and then you're going to need something behind you for when you start, because, you know, the infrastructure costs money. Trackways, photovoltaic systems, construction, you know. So, I think if you're going to embark on this, then really, as a single person, you really want to have about 30k behind you, with a family, 60k. Bear in mind that the Ecology Building Society does offer mortgages for One Planet developments.
So does it?
So that is also an option.
That's again pretty cracking, I think. Because, well, I mean, for a start off, obviously you barely get a shed for that out in the real world, and of course this expense is actually, a lot of it is going to be providing you with water and electricity and things like that that you're not going to have to pay too much for. So it's genuinely money well spent, it seems to me.
And once you're set up, you will have the support system. There comes a point, for us on our plot, it was about at year four, but it varies from plot to plot. There comes a point when, you know, you're working away on the land, really hard graft to start with, and then there comes a point, it's like going over the crest of a hill, where the land starts to support you, where the vegetable gardens start to be productive, where your land-based businesses are starting to give returns, you know, where the electricity networks are set up and your accommodation is sufficiently comfortable, whereby, you start to kind of feel like you're kind of rolling downhill. Mm. And then it just gets stronger and stronger, because the longer you're there, the more you invest in these kind of sustainable infrastructure networks, the more they can feed you.
What about the, because you're kind of, you sort of have to be in commerce, don't you, to do One Planet development. They want you. When I looked at it, I thought, market-facing subsistence agriculture, I thought, sounds hard to me. But then I started thinking about mushrooms and chilies and things. How well is the kind of commercial side going? You know, the need to provide enough veg for yourself and enough money to buy the rest of your veg and pay your council tax and all that. How's it working for people?
Well, it's interesting you ask. I've just seen an early draft of our six-year annual monitoring report. So I can give you some hard figures. So here we are, 6 years into the project. So this was our annual monitoring report from 2015 as an eco-village. So in terms of land-based produce, so this is kind of, this is everything from woodcraft to salad to cosmetics to all sorts of things we're producing here in the eco-village. The nine households at the core of the project here bought in £27,000 worth of produce.
In a year?
In 1 year.
Wow.
And then on top of that, in terms of land-based education, because we run a lot of courses, schools, colleges, universities, all sorts of people come here, we bought in £21,000. And then on top of that, directly from the land, because as part of our planning permission, we are required to put a value on that which we produce directly for ourselves, so like the food that we grow, the electricity that we produced £59,000 from the land. And so if you top those up, I mean, this is the real, you know, if there is a figure or if there is a line that shows the viability of One Planet development, this is it here. So we produced in 2015 from the land, from the 76 acres, £107,000 worth of produce. Activity. Now I want to compare that. So when we bought the land, it was down to sheep, and a tenant farmer was bringing in approximately £3,000 a year through the sale of lamb.
£3,000 a year.
Compared to, and now we're bringing in £107,000 a year, partly, you know, for produce for our own consumption, partly produce going into the local economy, and partly land-based sustainable education. That's something like a 35-fold increase in productivity.
And that represents a many-fold increase in the amount of variety of things being done and stuff being turned out and all of that. And that's pretty stunning. I did read recently that the average income of a Welsh farm now is £13,000 a year, less without its subsidies, which is less. It's about what two people would get if they were on the dole for running a farm. I thought when I heard those big figures you were talking about in the presentation I watched that you were talking about over the 5 years, but £107,000 over a year is amazing. Yeah. And that, given the way you're running things, that must be relatively comfortable, I would have thought, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, we certainly kind of enter a different kind of economy when you're living this lifestyle because, I mean, yes, we pay council tax, and yes, we have to run our vehicles, and yeah, we pay our mobile phone bills. Yeah, but we don't pay for our water. We don't pay for our electricity. We grow most of our own food. We meet most of our own needs kind of from the land as much as possible. So, you know, yeah, definitely. And also, you know, bear in mind that most households here, as well as doing all the land-based stuff, do have kind of other income streams to supplement things, to supplement their lives. Whether it be massage or a bit of local gardening or a bit of therapy work or a bit of this or a bit of that, you know, that kind of stuff goes on as well. And so, you know, in terms of land use, it's quite interesting. So previously, the 76 acres formed a small part of one farmer's estate.
Yeah.
You know. Whereas now it supports nine families, we're pouring out a whole massive diversity into the local economy, teaching, educating about sustainable land use, supporting ourselves largely from the land, you know, and providing all these other services locally.
And presumably there's, from the ground, there's a bit of, there must be a fair degree of, what should we say, slack in the way you can do your reporting. You only have to tell them what you know they need to know, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, there is a kind of, there's a degree of kind of trust that, yeah. that goes on. You know, we are trusted by the local authority to report what we're doing. Yeah, and having said that, you know, planning officers do visit from time to time, just because there's often kind of updated applications, new shed, different style barn, etc., etc., etc. So there is a kind of casual eye that's kept on the project to make sure that things add up. But it's, you know, it's fairly simple to see whether land is being worked, whether people are living sustainably. You can, you know, a trained eye can glance at a plot and kind of establish that fairly quickly. So, well, yeah, what you're saying is right. There is kind of elbow room in how we report. Over the 6 years that we've been producing annual monitoring reports, we have varied our reporting mechanisms from year to year.
Did you find the information systems important? Did you address them early on, or were they a kind of bolt-on?
No, we kind of built them in from the start. So, for example, with the traffic, we've got a traffic monitor that counts all the vehicles that come in and out of the Yika village. For their kind of ecological footprinting, you just kind of get into a habit. I mean, it's more a cultural thing. You know, you kind of just tune into that, and you come to appreciate, you know, roughly how much electricity as a household you use, you know, how much you spend on food, how much you spend on kind of telecoms, and it's just kind of it becomes quite simple. Okay, let's just look up the MOT. How many miles did we do in 2015? Here we are. Put that into the calculator. So you get into a kind of rhythm. You get used to it.
Yeah, but what about that year, the carbon footprint analysis? Because it's all a bit shaky in the guide notes. How easy is it for you? What they're doing, just so that people know, the basic measure of a human being's kind of lifetime use is expressed in global hectares per person. The average in Wales a few years back was 4.5 or so, and has recently gone up to 5. The requirement on OPD is initially to drive it down to 2.54 and eventually aim for 1.88 global hectares per person, all of which sounds horribly technical, but how easy is it to do doing what you're doing?
It is relatively easy. If you really are living a sustainable lifestyle, it's relatively easy to attain a one planet footprint. I mean, here at Lammas, we're living a 0.8 planet footprint. And what that actually means is that if everybody in the world lived as we do here at Lammas, there would be plenty of room to spare for wilderness.
And we'd have loads of
spare capacity.
Yeah, and we'd have loads of our own electricity, loads of our own water. The insects would be coming back and everything else. It's a pretty irresistible thing, isn't it, really?
Well, you know, that's part of the attraction. You know, I mean, you know, why not? If you're, let's just say you're a conventional family, you know, working in some 9-to-5 job in order to pay the mortgage, pay the bills, you know, on the treadmill, you know, the option of kind of doing something fulfilling that's got kind of real meaning, real value as a solution for the kind of human predicament, you know, as well as a healthy lifestyle, as well as grow your own food, as well as a kind of resilience. If there was a zombie apocalypse tomorrow, we would be pretty sorted here. Not only would we be able to sort of support ourselves, we actually have capacity to be able to support, you know, local community. And so that resilience is also quite attractive, particularly in today's world where, you know, the infrastructure, political, social mechanisms are starting to look pretty shaky.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I know the, can't remember his name, the author of the One Planet guidelines emphasises is as a major problem in terms of rural carbon footprint is the fact that a lot of the people who work in the country actually live in the town because they can't afford to rent in the country, and a lot of people who work in the country live in the town, and a lot of the people who live in the country work in the town. So, and he puts it all down to mobility. But one of the things that strikes me about the OPD is that for the first time we actually have the chance to get people consciously living and working close to each other.
In many ways, I think it's about perspective, Doctor, because it's kind of like, and this is the core difference between the English and the Welsh perspective, or vision. Let's put it in terms of vision. So the Welsh government appreciate that in order to have a sustainable future, there is a place for a reconsideration of the kind of of where the population lives, you know, and there is a place for redistributing some of that population back into the countryside.
Yeah.
That's what OPD is basically about. It's like, it's saying, you know, in order to be productive, we don't have to vacate the countryside of people and replace them with huge machines and massive mega farms. There is another way of doing it, whereby the people move back into the landscape and we create diverse, thriving local economies. And that is quite a contrast to the English perspective, which still clings to this, the countryside shall be reserved for the industrial agriculture.
Yeah.
Well, and the aristocracy, but yeah, that's the kind of, you know, core vision behind the English approach. You know, we've got to reserve the landscape for, you know, ever exploitative, you know, practices, GM crops, you know, bigger and bigger mega farms, etc. So that's what's at the core of this One Planet development policy is. You know, there's another way of looking at it.
Of course, whilst we do have industrial farming out in Wales, there strikes me as being two distinct kinds of farmer. I've met loads of really lovely, sympathetic, older guys, mostly, who I've seen kind of, you know, around and about looking at what's going on, and obviously quite enjoying seeing people do the work. Are you finding any farmers that are around and about you sympathetic to the way things are being done?
Well, in many ways, what we're doing here has more in common, particularly around here, out in West Wales, you know, what we're doing has got more in common with the kind of traditional smallholding model than it has with modern agribusiness. And so a lot of, particularly the old farmers, can really relate to what we're doing. Because when they come and they visit and they see the house cow, and they see the vegetable plot, and they see the small-scale fields and the orchards, they can remember it.
Correct, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So in many ways, it particularly here, because Wales has this, is much more rooted in the small-holding culture, and we do find a lot of sympathy, particularly from the kind of old boys, yeah.
Yeah, I know it's still within living memory here where the people from the village would help plant potatoes and peas and beans in the fields before we had just grass, and their exchange would be a row of potatoes or peas or beans, which they'd then either trade or barter or preserve. So it's not that far back from us. And what's been occurring to me as I've been talking to you is what would happen if the planning people realised what a bloody great idea this is and started subsidising farmers to encourage this sort of stuff on bits of their land, because actually some of the farms are big enough to put something like Lammas on it and not make too much of an indentation. In fact, if they're only pulling $3,000, you know, from a piece of land and you can turn it into 105, there's clearly got to be a business interest for the shrewd farmer there potentially as well, I would have thought, hasn't there?
Kind of, yes. Yes. I don't know whether it needs to go down that planning, the government subsidising it route. I mean, possibly.
I'm just thinking of a way of actually, because at the moment it seems to me that, and I know that, you know, a couple of years back you kind of shared my view that to a degree what OPD does is it prohibits stuff and makes it more difficult. What I'm trying to imagine is once it's, as it is being proven to be extremely advantageous in nearly all ways, in order to reach their kind of One Planet aims in a lifetime, 60 years, whatever it is, then they're going to have to spread it a little wider, and finding some way of encouraging the farmers to start considering it, whether it's subsidised or just by looking at it and going, well, look, frankly, you could earn a lot of money doing something like this than farming sheep.
Well, I mean, okay, my direct response is possibly going to be a bit controversial in that, you know, but bear with me though. I think that one of the biggest obstacles to OPD really kind of taking up and scaling up in Wales is the farming subsidy system.
Yeah.
Because for so long as the farmers are so heavily subsidised by the government or the EU, it kind of, first of all, it creates a whole false economy around the food production. And secondly, it holds land. It locks land into unsustainable, environmentally unfriendly farming practices.
Yeah, and in fact, I gather that those farms that are on average earning £13,000 probably take £20,000 in subsidies.
Which is there is no doubt that the farm subsidy system is what keeps farms alive.
It's kind of on its way out, isn't it?
Well, that's kind of what I'm hinting at. You know, I don't think that can be sustained in this kind of climate of economic austerity and political instability, particularly around Europe. Mm. You know, I think OPD's time will come. You know, and also just, you know, more and more people are looking at it as a viable alternative. More and more people are exploring it. I think just give it time, just give it space and time. It's going to take off. And I also think that there will always be a place for larger scale farming. You know, when it comes to the lowland plains, you know, we grow hardly any grain here in the Eco Village, for example. There's always going to be a case for large scale grain growing. But where this kind of project really excels is in the kind of foothills. Particularly the south-facing foothills, you know, give a load of permaculture activists, which is, you know, in one sense who we are, some south-facing kind of hillside, and we can turn it into something amazing, something remarkable, absolutely productive, as the Lamasica village, you know, demonstrates beyond any doubt, in a way that, you know, mainstream farming practices can't really compete.
And it sounds like it's improving as the years go by, as well as you get more people and more experience. The experience for everybody and people who visit must be improving as well.
I think so. Hey, why don't you come and visit? We do run guided tours every Saturday from the beginning of April to the end of September. You just turn up at 11 o'clock at the Eco Village and you'll get to have a look around the place, meet some of the residents and see for yourself.
I'd love to do that. In fact, we'd probably like to come down for a few days and sort of help out around the place, because we're used to wielding the tools and doing the work. And tends to be a really great way of getting to meet people. So yeah, I should think you probably will see us before the end of the year, and we love Pembrokeshire. It's an amazingly long way away from Mid Wales, though, you know. It doesn't look far on the map, but it's kind of 3.5 hours.
Yeah, it's a long way from everywhere. That's part of the beauty of it.
Absolutely right. We were talking last time we spoke as well, and because one of the concerns that's come up in my discussions with people is, what about the general cost to the council of all of this? You've obviously got your planning stuff. Do you have to pay business rates?
None of our premises really kind of qualify for business rates. The one space that could qualify for business rates, which is our community hub kind of centre, that kind of is kind of exempt because Lammas itself is a community benefit society, which is akin to some kind of charitable cooperative, and so is by and large exempt from this rate. Coming back to it, cost of the council, we all pay council tax. You know, we're kind of treated by the council in the same way as any other smallholder, small-scale landowner, small-scale businesses, and where taxes and charges apply, they are levied.
Right, yeah. And what was that structure? You said a community benefit society.
Yes, yes. There's been some changes to the cooperative laws recently. We used to be what's called an industrial and provident society, and now we're a community benefit society. I mean, it's not worth getting too tangled up in it. We're basically a cooperative for the benefit of the wider community. Way to think of it.
Very good. And is it harder to do in a national park than it would be outside one?
There is, I would just say there's another consideration in a national park, and that's that I think you just have to be a little bit more careful about your visual impact. That's the main thing with national parks. Yeah, if you find a site in a national park that's tucked away, not overlooked, then yes. You'll be fine. But if you find a site that is exposed and is going to create a project with high visual impact, then, yeah, think carefully.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Oh, I have another question in my head there, but it's just gone. That sometimes happens. Am I going to be able to remember what it was? Oh, yeah, that's right. It was... obviously, there's a lot of detailed planning before you even set about the build and the moving onto the land. Were there any bits of the plan that took a lot longer than you expected? Was there any of it that caught you by surprise, generally? I mean, like, what's it like building structures, for example? Because I'm aware that these alternative building techniques, whilst quicker sometimes than building a proper house, can take a while.
Certainly, by and large, the approach to construction here is labour-intensive and cheap on materials. You know, that is generally the natural building approach. You buy local natural materials, timber, straw, stone, and you work with those rather than buying prefabricated products that you can just knock up into a house. So, yeah, construction does take a long time. I think, yes, embarking on this type of project requires a wide range of skills, and certainly quite a few of the One Planet applications that are going through on at the moment are making it slightly simpler for themselves by choosing to live in cabin or cabin type structures, and you know, some of them even caravans, or what would, you know, ostensibly qualify as a caravan. That is a way of making your life simpler. And yeah, I would say that if there was one thing that the Lammas residents underestimated, it was how long and how much energy it takes to self-build a dwelling house, particularly if you're going, you know, and through building regs. You need quite a lot of careful project management, quite a lot of skills involved in doing something like that. So, yeah.
And you do have to really adhere to the building regs, don't you? Because there's only a limited number of sort of buildings that aren't covered by them.
For your dwelling houses, unless your dwelling house qualifies as a caravan, then yes, you do have to adhere to building regs.
Okay.
But, you know, and that in itself has been a learning curve, in that, you know, there are, if you go with a private building control body, then it's a choice. And if you choose at the outset, you can choose to go privately. There are building control companies that specialise in natural building, and it is well worth paying that little bit extra to have a building control officer who is familiar with straw bale building. Breathable walls and natural finishes. So yeah, that's also been a good lesson.
Mm-hmm. And what about because one of the things in all my travellings around communities and stuff, one of the things that seems to always provide a challenge is basically the interpersonal stuff. You know, people don't always get on with other people. Have you found that to be the case, and have you developed systems to kind of do the dispute solution or whatever?
I think you're right. I think the interpersonal stuff is one of the more challenging things. I mean, perhaps that's just part of the culture that we come from. You know, in essence, we're coming from a not only a rootsless culture, but a culture of kind of isolation. You know, television maybe has been a wonderful kind of invention for humanity, but in many ways I think it's been quite isolating. So yeah, I think you're right in that regard, and I would say that we are continuing to develop kind of structures and social mechanisms for dealing with that. And I think one of the things that Lammas really got right was this, I mean, I often refer to it as the hermit principle, and that's the idea that anybody can come and live at the Eco Village, and anyone has the right to completely withdraw from any kind of social interaction with their neighbours. And that's a really healthy, important mechanism. So, you know, there are meetings, you can or may decide not to go. There are social gatherings, you may or may not decide to go. You can choose and design your level of involvement with the community aspects. And that is a really healthy mechanism to put into place for any of the large-scale projects. And also bear in mind, you know, the One Planet Development Policy works as a single household policy or a small, I mean, eco-hamlet, eco-village like Klamath, but it can also be scaled up. It has the potential to work for 50, 100 unit applications. And in the future, I think we're going to see more of those, you know, particularly, you know, if, as when the farming subsidies start to waver, drop, etc. You know, I think that in time, some of the larger farmsteads will lend themselves to kind of being turned over to larger scale eco-village developments.
Yeah. Yes, indeed, which will be, I think that's going to be one of the interesting things, isn't it? Because I'm looking at the various models. I think, obviously, having several households and, you know, 50-odd people or whatever it is actually quite a nice, versatile thing. I'm wondering what it's going to be like for people who come along and try and do it as a single household, or people who try to come along and live as six or eight people rather than kind of two or three households. We're obviously going to get a lot more information, aren't we, as these different models work their way through.
Yeah, and I mean, that was one of the key reasons we chose to do Lammas the way that we did, was because doing something with a larger number of households means that you can establish an alternative culture. Yeah, and that's really key. And that's part of the attraction. That's why there is so much peripheral and local activity here, is that, you know, we have created and are sustaining and is naturally kind of evolving this whole alternative culture. Because, you know, in many ways, to undertake a One Planet development is quite challenging. It's a bit like swimming upstream, because you're trying to do things sustainably and trying to create land-based produce and land-based education in the context of a totally, wholly unsustainable economy and society. You know, that is challenging. And so to surround yourself with people of a similar attitude and perspective is really, I wouldn't underestimate that. And generally, if people are kind of, you know, hunting around for plots of land for One Planet developments, I would tend to encourage people to look towards those areas of Wales where there are existing alternative communities and cultures.
Yes, I think that's good advice, because I think the closer these places are to each other, the better they're going to work. So you end up with a kind of network of networks rather than having them kind of isolated about the place.
Yeah, definitely, and it works on all sorts of levels. You know, you want to put a new cover on your polytunnel. You know, you can just text around your local friends and then turn up and there you are. Hooray, you've got a little team helping you. Right through to, okay, you want to go away to a festival with your family. You know, is there someone local who can come and milk your goats or whatever? It works on all sorts of levels.
And also, I guess that if you inevitably people generate surplus in this sort of during this sort of exercise, and it means that people are really close by to move the surplus onto one way or the other.
Definitely, I mean, that happens a lot here at the Eco Village. There's a lot of trade exchange, kind of, there's a lot of free economy stuff goes on here at the Eco Village.
Well, I mean, a lot of people's waste is somebody else's raw material, and if there's people around, there's more likely that that kind of swap's going to be immediately available to you.
Yep, absolutely.
Brilliant. Well, I think that Synchro's just put in the chat box, she's put, what an optimistic vision, thanks, Tao. And there's other people who like the sound of it as well, want to see your plans and see what's going on and stuff. I thought it'd be interesting to the guys at PIR. And I want to finish with a little bit that you put in one of your letters, saying that we're basically committed to playing our part in finding a solution, living lightly on the earth, managing our small pieces of land with sensitivity and love, and maximising the food, craft and fuel produced on the land. I thought that really said it all, mate.
Great. Good. Thank you, Doctor.
Well, thank you very much for coming on, and we would like to come and see you, and perhaps we can find more people to talk to for the radio if we come down to Lammas.
Great, I'm sure you can.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for making time for us, and I'll probably keep in touch if that's all right with you.
Definitely, yeah.
And see you sometime in the future.
Brilliant, look forward to meeting you in person.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot for being there, Tao. I do appreciate it, and I'll play a couple of tunes and call your friend Pete on next.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Excellent stuff. Thank you, sir. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
There you go, folks. That was Tao Winbush from Lammas, which is one of the One Planet developments in Wales. And it sounds like an all-round great thing, doesn't it? It's really, in a way, it's really marvellous that it's being allowed to happen. And I hope that it goes the way that Tao's looking to there. And I don't see any reason why it shouldn't, given all of the benefits that might accrue to us. I shall certainly be watching carefully to see if the requirements in the OPD guidance notes actually become more or less complex, to see whether there's a greater number or fewer restrictions put on the people who are trying to do this. But in the meantime, I think that was an absolutely excellent and really uplifting description of what can happen when people actually get the opportunity to do the kind of thing that we know a lot of people would like to do. And I can sort of see how this kind of planning system might be helpful in its way at kind of establishing this sort of thing, because I can imagine, having seen what people can attempt, having not attempted it before and expect to get it right and not, then this kind of project really does need a fair bit of thinking about. And if nothing else, the planning permission will make that kind of thinking happen, as it were. So we'll be keeping an eye on that and seeing how it goes. Coming up shortly will be Pete the Hat to talk to us about the One Planet Council, which is helping people work their way through this tremendously complicated system. But before that, we're going to play a couple of tunes, the first of which is Hey Mr. Landlord from Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra, because you can kiss goodbye to landlords as well, eh? Wouldn't that be marvellous? Here we go. There we go, seize the day there, and no DSS, which of course is another thing we'll be trying to get away with the One Planet development. And having chatted with Tao, I'm now joined on the line by Pete the Hat. Welcome, Pete, to Dr. Rock's radio show.
Hello.
Thanks very much for joining us on People's Internet Radio. And
you're quite welcome.
It's great to have you there, sir. Thanks very much. When all the One Planet development and stuff started, it was realised that it was very complicated, and so a kind of support, what I take to be a support organisation, the One Planet Council, was set up, of which you're a member. Is that right?
That's broadly speaking the case. Yeah, the council came out of a gathering of concerned parties, really, that was held at Lammas. It was called by Tao and a number of other practitioners and participants because of the very wide-ranging groundswell of interest that had been generated by the combination of the establishment of the Lammas Eco Village and by the adoption of the policy, which we must remember followed Lammas, not the other way around. So the policy offered an opportunity and a hope that the whole of Wales was basically open country for eco-village-style low-impact developments, and the purpose of the One Planet, the purpose of the gathering at Lammas was to discuss next steps, what we do in order to actually go from this is government policy to here are a bunch of real projects, and here is a way that real people can engage with this process. So that gathering brought something like 100 people together over the course of the day, and from it, it was decided to form a formal body that would stand between the government and its policy and the people on the ground to act as some kind of channel of communication and enable people to put forward tangible proposals that had a hope of success in the planning system. So that's the core objective of the One Planet Council.
And has it been working well for the people who are putting in the development? Do you think it's helpful and moving things forward a bit more quickly?
Well, I have to say, from a distance, it looks to me like it's been massively successful, because at the time that it started, it was very much the policy was very new, and it was very little understood. And there was a lack of willingness by planning officers and planning committee members to engage with this strange and newfangled thing that many of them saw as being a drain on their resources. They understood little of the motivation and thinking behind it. And were in a position where they were not equipped to cope with even the very best formed One Planet development policy applications. So in the early days, applications were routinely rejected, which left the applicants in the position of making a decision that do we carry on with this and go to appeal, which was burdensome, potentially expensive, certainly stressful, with no guarantee of a favourable outcome, despite the fact that what they were trying to do was government policy. And then, a lot of the early refusals were across the board. It was officers recommending refusal. It was members rejecting, and this was largely due to the policy itself being largely misunderstood. So, on the part of the Welsh Government, credit where credit's due, they put forward a working party to produce a set of guidance notes to be used both by council officers in how to handle an application, and that would also therefore be valuable to applicants to ensure that an application was properly formulated and had the correct information and proposals contained in it that would make an application credible and hopefully lead to success all three. So the guidance notes actually were the first stage towards making a difference. The second stage, and this to my mind is far and away the most valuable thing that the One Planet Council has achieved, was the creation of training days. And essentially what training days do is they bring both applicants and council officers and any other interested parties, academics or elected members, for example, are welcome to attend these sessions, and they go through rigorously the guidance notes, explaining what they mean and how they're to be interpreted and how they're to be applied to specific applications. And since that process has begun, since these training days have been made available and some council officers have attended them, we're finding that applications are being processed routinely and recommended for approval by the officers that have actually been through this process, and their colleagues, of course. We only need one officer in any given planning department to understand the process, and that's seen, it's very much been a path to the proper application of the TAN 6 policy.
Well, that's one of the things, isn't it? I think the thinking about the guidance notes, because I have read TAN 6, TAN 18 and TAN 22 and the various other notes that lie behind this, and it certainly must be said the guidance notes make it all a lot clearer.
We're fortunate in that one of the parties that wrote the guidance notes is a participant and principal trainer in the training days that the One Planet Council organises.
Oh, that's very good. So you've got some of the authors involved as well. And do you find you're attracting more people and a bigger variety of people to these training days as time goes by?
I'm not responsible for either design, implementation or administration of the courses, so I can only tell you what I've heard through the grapevine, which is that increasing numbers of potential applicants are attending these training days and finding them extremely valuable. Certainly we now know that the quality of the applications that is going in is massively improved by attendance at training day. As someone who's engaged in attempting to keep on top of planning law and process in England, I know how valuable it is to spend time with a peer group and ideally with somebody one or more people involved in the application and the interpretation of the policies to ensure that time and effort are not wasted on things that are flawed, inadequate, ill-informed, and so forth. There is a downside to all of this, of course, which is that actually the rigour demanded by the One Planet Development Policy, which we all need to bear in mind, that this policy is an exemption policy. And essentially what this means is that somebody that puts forward a proposal that qualifies as a One Planet development gets the exceptional privilege of building themselves a new home in the open countryside. And that is one of the things that the whole of planning law and practice in England and Wales since the mid-1940s has been designed to stop.
Yes.
So this is a unique privilege, and it is proper that it should not be handed out willy-nilly to anybody who comes along and just says, I want to do this. But the downside of this is that the rigour demanded by the application process is acting as a barrier to many perfectly sound people who have no wish other than to live in a low-impact way on land that they can afford and support themselves by their own sweat, not so much barred, but excluded by the level of application and academic and intellectual rigour demanded by these applications. So we do know that the majority of successful applications have been put in by people with postgraduate degrees.
Is that right? I didn't know that. It doesn't actually surprise me, because one of the things being before I ran away, I used to be an administrator and a logistics manager, and I recognise the difficulties that are presented simply by the planning and the reporting and everything. I can imagine that a whole section of society just wouldn't be able to do that.
There are plenty of people out there in Wales and in the wider UK who've looked at the policy and said, well, we don't want anything to do with that. The bar is just too high.
Yeah.
It will exclude too many people. And for example, this has led Simon Fairley, who you may or may not have mentioned previously, but the editor of The Land magazine and the leading thinker and theorist of low-impact developments in England and Wales, it's led him to say that in many ways he considers it's going to be easier to get a permission for a low-impact development in England than it is in Wales, despite the existence of a policy in Wales explicitly designed to encourage such things. And the reason he said that is that because of the height at which the bar is set for a Pan6 OPD application.
Yeah.
However, that remark was made before the One Planet Council training days and before the level of support that One Planet Council is able to bring to applicants. So
yeah.
And it's a fluid situation. The One Planet Council has only been ticking along for a couple of years, and we've only done two sets of training days, and already the impact of that work is beginning to show in the officers supporting applications rather than recommending refusal, and in those supported applications being granted by committee members.
Yeah. So do you feel, what's your feeling? Do you think it's easier to do this sort of thing in in England than it is in Wales, or would you like to see an OPD in England as well?
Well, a friend of mine who works as a professional in the planning system, over a dinner table conversation, said, well, surely all development should be low impact. If we're talking sustainability, and ultimately all development should be low impact. In England, we have a national planning policy framework, which is the theoretical basis on which all planning policy and all planning decisions are supposed to be based. And in the preamble, it sets out the statement that there is a presumption in favour of sustainable development, and then goes on for several hundred paragraphs, completely failing to define or offer any methodology for definition or monitoring or measurement of what sustainable development actually means.
Mm-hmm.
So, as usual, it's completely open to any planning officer, any planning committee member, and any planning inspector to make that judgment according to their own wit, wisdom, or lack of.
Mm.
So, we really have... It is essentially down to the discretion of the professionals and the authorities in the process.
And that can lead to a bit of difficulty, can't it? Because there does tend to be a bit of churn in planning departments, and so you quite often find yourself dealing with a series of people rather than just one.
Indeed so, yes. Well, once you get past an area officer, you're dealing with whatever the head of the department says policy should be. You're dealing with whatever the political flavour of the planning committee might be.
Mm.
You're dealing with whatever agenda an inspector may bring to the table on the basis of their personal feelings and experience, and whatever directives are issued by DCLG, which is ultimately political. It's interesting that the news release issued today by DCLG indicates that they're setting up an expert panel to discuss the meaning of sustainable development. And I was not the least surprised, but as usual shocked and appalled, to see that half the panel will be from developers, major house builders and legal firms.
Mm.
And obviously, anybody operating outside of the mainstream paradigm is not going to get a look in.
This is one of the other things that was worrying me a little bit about it, is quite often we the people are made to do all the research, spend all the money and all that kind of stuff just so that it turns into a corporate interest in the long run. So I'm interested to hear you say that. And I was also thinking that that's one of another of the concerns I had about OPD in Wales, is that because the whole thing comes up for review every 5 years or so, when you can change your business plan, because obviously things change on the ground. But I'm also wondering whether that means that the One Planet, the people who are doing the planning departments, are going to be able to change their requirements as well and make it just a little bit more difficult for people.
I don't see that as being an issue, because the policy is made by the Welsh Government. And it is the duty of the planning officers to enact that policy on the ground. And so they are duty-bound to do as they're told by the central government policy. So the Sustainable Rural Communities policy, that's Technical Advice Note 6, within which the exemption class for new rural homes, which we're all referring to as OPD, or Open Planet Development, all of that stuff, that's central Welsh policy. So the officers on the ground cannot alter the rules of the game.
What happens though when the administration changes and maybe the policy changes?
Well, that's entirely up to the Welsh voters who they elect, and that could be in a couple of months with devolved assembly elections coming up. The flavour could change.
It'd be interesting to see how that works out, won't it? Because obviously people have to work quite hard to get to wherever it is they're at. And one of the problems with the early OPDs were that the goalposts were being moved around.
Well, I think the goalposts were where they were, but it was more a case of there being an impenetrable fog in between the action and the goalposts. nobody really knew what they were doing. And this has largely been resolved by the creation of the guidance notes, and the work of the One Planet Council essentially has been to ensure that all the participants on both sides understand what's being played out, so that there's no false hope, but at the same time, hard work is rewarded.
Yes, exactly right. And I'd still hope that in the long run, by looking at these projects, they might find it easier and a bit less demanding to identify them as time goes by.
I think there's some interesting sort of philosophical questions that come down the line about what the One Planet development actually means, because in theory, the whole of the Welsh planning system is supposed to be leading in the direction of Wales as a whole nation living on its own footprint.
Mm.
And it's quite straightforward. If you look at the how thin the population is, once you get away from the southern belt and the northeast, people are thin on the ground in Wales. So the ecological footprint of the city of Cardiff, for example, is somewhere between a third and a half of the whole of Wales.
So, is that right?
Yeah, that was a figure from a footprinting textbook from nearly 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it may have changed.
Yeah, yeah.
Given that the objective of the Welsh government that passed that legislation was to bring all of Welsh planning into the One Planet, a single planet's fair use of land resource, it's obvious that the mainstream is making no effort whatever to meet that standard.
No, and of course that is the another area for hope, as I was chatting about Tao with this a bit, is the idea that as the exemplars are set, there will need to be a spread of this policy into the wider rural community at least, and possibly into the urban community as well. And we might see this kind of change happening at a much more rapid rate as a result, if they're serious about getting it all done in 60 years, that is.
I think we haven't got 60 years.
That's the note.
Personally, I'm not so sure we've got 60 months.
No, I agree. I'm not so sure we got three.
But the essential point here that I'm trying to get across is that we can look at the success or failure of what we, as a movement, the One Planet Council, and its participants. We are a handful, in all honesty. We are a fly on the back of an elephant in terms of what is getting planned for and developed and built in Wales at the moment. I think it's very true to say that establishing exemplars, whilst necessary, is not in itself an end that is sufficient for what needs to be done.
Correct, yeah, I'd agree.
And the exemplars are there to show that it can be done. And this is in large measure why it's important for us to enable it to be available to any willing participant. So, in other words, that it not be a thing that is so hard and complicated that only well-equipped and resourced and trained and educated people are able to use this policy. The general feeling is that it should be open to anybody. So there is, coming from within the practitioners and the One Planet Council, there's a definite awareness that at the moment it's quite elite, it's quite English, despite the fact that it's happening in Wales. Many of the people that are buying land and trying to set up One Planet developments are coming from England, or of English origin. These are issues. The protection of Welsh language and culture is a serious material consideration in Welsh planning matters. A number of people, when the conversation goes around the world, we're looking at this piece of land in Carmarthen or Cardigan or Gwynedd or wherever it might be, and say, well, what can we do that will enhance our chances of getting this application through? One of the things that I recommend is they at least begin to learn Welsh.
Yeah.
Because if nothing else, it protects you from the secret knowledge of conversations that are had in a language by the members of the committee or by the officers, and so on and so forth. And you know, new people coming into communities and learning the language and culture has to be a good thing.
In Wales, it really helps. It really does. There's a whole culture in Wales who actually believe that even if you were born in Wales, if you don't speak Welsh, you ain't Welsh. And it's still very much, you know, around that kind of thing. And also, one of the things I was chatting with Tao about is how important it is to get on with your neighbours. And it really, really helps if at least some of the people speak Welsh. I've seen it completely, like a farmer will come at you across his land really quite angry. But if he says Cymraeg to you and you can answer in Welsh, then you'll see it really soften straight away, and that's a cracking example of how important that can be in terms of relations, shall we say, with the locals. And it's also true, I think, that a lot of the activity that's happening in Wales is actually motivated or started by blow-ins, incomers, Englishmen, whatever we want to call them, you know.
Well, I think it's a symptom of the lack of opportunity that exists in England, and I think it also reflects the economic and cultural distance from the capital. So you know, once you fall off the end of a motorway and you're no longer in a couple of hours' reach of London, property prices start to go down, land prices start to go down. And so you know, West Wales has always been a place where people from England have been able to afford to buy property, to buy land, and have a go I hesitate to use the word alternative lifestyles, but that's kind of where it is.
Yeah.
It's something that is not mainstream. Having said that, there are interesting projects that have been developed, even within London, within the M25. There's the BEDZ project, which is an attempt at a purpose-built, zero-carbon, low-impact co-housing project. It's not One Planet, not by a long way, but it approaches in design and execution some kind of idea of what zero carbon housing could look like. And it has many of the characteristics of what would be looked for in something like an eco-village where people have the opportunity to live and work within very short distances. And the kind of opportunity that if you wanted to buy that in the mainstream, you would have to be looking for a property of the order of hundreds of thousands of pounds pretty much anywhere in England.
And that's the thing. I think that's another of the key points about these particular developments, is that they get people to the point where they can live and work close to each other, which is, it's good for social reasons. It's good because you don't have to drive around so much. It's good because it makes things cheaper. It's good because
The drive around one is actually quite an interesting angle, because a lot of what passes for sustainable development thinking in English planning, and to a large extent in Wales, there was a kind of ripple went through the planning professionals, both in terms of practitioners and education, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when all of a sudden people were starting to have to think about sustainable development and what does that mean. And back in the day, when these ideas were first being seriously discussed by planning professionals rather than just a few fringe academics and road protesters and so on, where they came up with was sustainable development is minimising the use of the private car. And what this led to was actually a strengthening of the underlying philosophy that people in the countryside are bad news.
Yeah.
And what it didn't address, and it continues to fail to address, is that actually people in the countryside could be really good news for sustainable development. And that, in many ways, is the obstacle that we have to overcome. But because it's such a strong narrative, and it was supported across the board by planning theoreticians, and by planning professionals, and by the people in government at the time that were leading on government policy on planning, this whole narrative of reducing car use, get people into towns, and that development in rural areas has to happen in what they call growth clusters. So a village that's lucky enough to still have a shop, a school, a petrol station, is where the new houses will be built.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, for example, in Ceredigion, they had a 10-year master plan for development that was based on growth clusters, at least four of which the schools have closed.
Yeah.
So the whole plan falls apart because the rest of the system and the whole of the elaborate, highly developed, sophisticated civilization that we have is no longer able to sustain schools. But, stating the bleeding obvious, if there were more people living on the land around those growth clusters, there'd be more children there to go to the schools, and the schools can stay open.
Yes, yes, I in fact read I read an essay by James Shorten, the author of the PDF guidelines, called So Long and Thanks for All the Policies. And he rather inscrutably, as far as I was concerned, actually concentrates on mobility. I was thinking of visiting the essay later. He concentrates on mobility as the problem, but I do pretty much what you do with that, which is, you know, the schools are disappearing. The bus services out here, they're not even laughable. Even in theory on the timetable, they're impractical, but in the actual the actuality that manifests. And all of these things are really important for helping to measure your carbon footprint and all that sort of stuff. And the services are just being removed. We actually need these developments to be here quite quickly, because our schools are vanishing very fast now.
Well, many years ago, in 1980 to be precise, I participated in a project that was to establish a cooperative village community. And the project was called Cartwheel, and it came out of a group that emerged from existing very intentional communities and people that were living in urban situations. But the Cartwheel Manifesto, which still exists in various places, it's quite thin in terms of its internet presence, because obviously all of this material predates the digital age. But the Cartwheel Manifesto included a commitment that came from participants then in the home education movement, that the village community would not have a school, and that children would learn by participation and example from the life and work of the adults around them.
Yeah.
And I think, having spent then most of my adult life around families that were either de-schooled or struggling to access mainstream education for various reasons, I see a great deal of merit, personally, in the idea of not having mainstream schooling.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, some of the adults I know here are at one and the same time kind of fighting for the survival of the school, at the same time as kind of realising that they don't actually want to send their children there anyway, which leaves them in a very interesting position.
Yeah, of the moment, in fact, yeah, there's a proposal up now that the entire school estate everywhere across the UK to be handed over to some private sector arrangement. So it's another theft of the commons that's being perpetrated upon us.
It certainly is, but it's also a kind of invitation to look at the kind of thing you've just been talking about, because it makes it bloody obvious what the schools are.
So I think these bigger questions, I think, should certainly form part of the strategic thinking in our organisation as One Planet Council. And also I would encourage the participants and practitioners of One Planet Developments to be thinking in terms of meeting other needs out with the basic survival needs that are measured in the One Planet application process. And I think this kind of leads us in the direction of, well, do you have to be a farmer or a woodworker if you're going to have a One Planet lifestyle? And at the moment, it appears the answer is yes.
Yeah.
So if you're wanting to live low impact life in Wales, you either have to have enough money to buy land and property on which you can do what the hell you like, or you have to have a business which is based on meeting your needs from the land, or either as horticulture, agriculture, or some form of woodland produce coming out of here. And so it somewhat limits your life options. If, for example, you're a professional nurse and you want to live in a low impact way, the bleeding edge of the conversations going around the One Planet Council at the moment are very much focused on this idea that we have to make this way of living on one planet, available to people who don't want to be farmers, but who have nevertheless significant contributions to make to sustainable communities.
Especially being as the, you know, Tower's telling us we've got maybe 50 grown-ups and 30-odd offspring as the core of Lammas, they're going to need nurses and people who won't have time to be growing potatoes.
Indeed. I don't want to get too distracted into the detail, but just growing potatoes is never going to be enough of a business to support a One Planet home and to generate sufficient income for a small acreage business. And I've said from personal experience that the time that I spend on growing produce, I grow high value density produce, like things like garlic and fresh herbs and stuff. Potatoes are grown by a bloke up the road who farms 100 acres organically. I buy my spuds off him for £5 a sack in season.
Yeah.
It would be absolutely insane for me to waste my time and effort and my little bit of land that I've got access to growing potatoes. Doesn't make any sense at all. So the in order to generate a good income, so you can have a quality of life from a small area of land, you have to be into the realm of high added value product.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
And that in itself calls for a lot of creative thinking, a lot of imagination, and an ability to create products from the produce of your land, whatever that might be, and to be able to sell them to people.
Yeah.
And perhaps there's a paradox here that the successful low-impact communities and practitioners, those that are able to produce stuff and go out and sell them in the open market to customers, those customers are making their money in the mainstream in utterly unsustainable ways. So although the One Planet practitioner has done all the stuff by the book and is producing the required percentage of their needs from their land and the product thereof, that 30% on top, the cash income, is coming from an unsustainable mainstream.
Although it is hoped, isn't it, in the guidelines that the very presence of a sustainable or low impact community will actually lower the carbon footprint and stuff of the community that surrounds it.
Yep, that's undoubtedly the case. But for me, perhaps the more important way of looking at this is the cherry on the cake, as Rob Hoskins put it. Back in the day, you used to be able to, within your community, source all of the things that you needed for your cake.
Yeah.
And then, if you were lucky, somebody might bring in some cherries from an exotic place at a remote distance. They might come in on a train or whatever. But nowadays, the whole bloody thing comes from a distance in a supermarket box. So the more there are people producing high-value product from small areas of land, the higher the quality of life that can be enjoyed sustainably by more people, more connected to more good-quality, fresher, local food and other kinds of land-based products, whether it be clothing, furniture, toys, and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
and moving away from everything's made in China, made of plastic, in a shipping container.
Yeah. Most of the stuff I've been looking at has been concerned with One Planet development in the open countryside. I gather there's another form of it which encourages development on the fringes of existing settlements. Is that correct?
Yeah, this goes back to the question that we were just talking about. What place is there in this for people who want to live a low-impact or one-planet lifestyle but don't want to be farmers or woodworkers, for example, a nurse or a teacher even? So this also goes to a question raised by Simon in England that what we need to be doing is putting low-impact developments on the edge of settlements. So the term of art that we were using was edge of settlement, low-impact developments, but this is now, the thinking has developed, and that we're now thinking about settlement-connected one-planet development. So the idea here is that there are potentially clusters of zero carbon in construction and use housing, which is in the open countryside, but is very closely connected, tangibly, to a community of the scale of an identified planning growth hub. So by talking in terms of settlement connected rather than edge of settlement, hopefully we're looking to bypass the hope value that landowners put on edge of settlement land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for those that don't know, essentially what this means is if you own an orchard or a paddock and it's right on the line between a village and the open countryside, at some point in the next 20 years, there's a possibility that you might get planning permission to build houses on that land, in which case it goes from being worth a few thousand pounds an acre to a few hundred thousand pounds an acre. And so the people that own that land are very happy to sit on it over generations in the hope that if they don't profit from it, their children or their grandchildren might profit from it in that way. So what we're trying to do is to break that assumption. There are ways that there's a project actually in Herefordshire at the moment which is being promoted by an architect's practice and a co-housing group, where they have a proposition to build a passive house village of 150 passive house dwellings. And it is an ambitious project. It's over considerable acreage. But the farmer, the owner of the land, was willing to sell the land at a lower price than if the land was being developed by a mainstream house builder.
Okay, yeah.
And the logic of this is that he would never have a hope in hell of a mainstream house builder getting permission to build on that land at normal density, for all sorts of reasons to do with the land itself and its drainage and road access and so on and so forth. So the only way that he could realise any hope of enhanced value on that land was to enter into an unconventional project at low density. So the passive house village is proposed at a density of 8 or 9 units per acre. That is the kind of housing density at which mainstream housing was being built in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah.
So big gardens, plenty of open space, and so on and so forth. And that project flew through planning. Many of the villagers objected to it, and there's interesting stories about people objecting and then being shown the letters of objection that were received when the houses in which they lived were being proposed.
Brilliant!
Yeah. But the developers, the architectural firm that were leading that project, did a lot of very good engagement work and have overcome those. And the officers' comments on their recommendation for approval, despite it being against some parts of the adopted policies, actually give us hope that the officers do understand what sustainable development means, why we need zero carbon in use housing, and so on and so forth. It's an example of how the professionals can shine in the field if they're given the opportunity to do so.
So there's basically a lot to smile about in all of this, isn't that? You know, even amongst the most cynical amongst us, we can see that this is all better than, well, it's potentially more to our advantage than what was going on 10 or 15 years ago, when, as you say, we just weren't allowed to do any of this.
Absolutely, yeah, very much so. We are where we are, and you know, nobody set out to get to where we are 20 or 30 years ago.
No.
But it is the case that where we are now is the result of, as the saying goes, standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, for example, in Pembrokeshire, a lot of the momentum was created by Tony Wrench's Roundhouse.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen in a vacuum. It happened in a field where there was architects and planning thinkers and academics were already looking at what was happening in Somerset with a view to you know, what are the policy implications of people who want to live a very poor, low-cash lifestyle that the vast majority of people would not understand or would run a mile from and would object strongly if they were forced into it. So there was this fantastic scenario where Brian Munger, who was a pioneer bender dweller in Somerset, was asking a council officer, well, if you won't let us live like this where we are, where can we live like this? And was told by the council senior planner, you have no right to be poor.
Wow.
and it is the paradox of a materially affluent society that people that have no power are forced to live in a kind of material poverty where they're dependent on the state for housing, which just makes rent landlords so much richer. They're dependent on a benefit system for their daily bread. Although I have to say, at the moment, that theory seems to be under attack, and we don't know how long that can last. But the only way out of that, of course, is to have the means to provide for your own well-being. And bringing the whole thing round in a circle, this is precisely the paradigm on which the One Planet Development Model is built.
Mm.
It's providing responsibly for our own well-being on the resources equitably available to us.
Yeah. So what would you kind of, in just about in closing, what do you think the next step should be to sort of basically try and capitalise on the advantage we seem to be developing here?
Well, I wish more of the capable people would stay in England and fight the corner for policy here. But who am I to tell people where to put their effort and their treasure? People want to get on with their lives and don't want to necessarily fight battles. So it's clearly the case that we have a system, we have a policy, we have legislation, we have guidance, and we have a vehicle through the One Planet Council for ensuring that applicants are as well equipped as we can possibly make them. And so the pressure, there's two pressures now in Wales. One is to ensure that all of the planning authorities understand and can handle the policy properly. And at the moment, that is mostly focused on the urban fringe in the southeast around Cardiff, Caerphilly, and in Pembrokeshire. So other councils in Wales have yet to come on stream at the required level of understanding. And the second thing is to push the envelope. So to bring the One Planet philosophy more into areas that are seen as being the realm of mainstream development. So that's the settlement connected stuff, that's the providing zero and low carbon housing for anybody, not just for farmers and woodland workers.
Yeah. And then presumably
in England, what we're pressing for in England is policies that are supportive of any genuinely sustainable way of life.
Yeah,
anything would do, and I'm encouraged massively by some people I'm in contact with, who are proposing an intentional communal dwelling to be built from scratch, and the argument that is going to be taken to the planners for this new building in the countryside is that it is sustainable development. So therefore, there's a presumption it should be permitted, and the way of proving it's sustainable development is to invoke the Welsh methodology.
Right, okay.
So the proposal essentially is to use Welsh law to underpin an application in an English planning system. Mm. I think many more people should be doing this.
Yeah.
To create a pressure, to create a momentum in the direction of a sensible policy.
Well, there's certainly plenty of place for it in England, I would have thought. I mean, not obviously in me. Well, like you say, even in London, potentially, in cities, outside cities, it would be good to see this sort of thing starting to develop there.
Well, for the people who are interested in looking at contrarian points of view, I once actually examined the stated purpose, aims and objectives of Greenbelt land around our major cities and conurbations in England, and strictly by the definitions, low-impact development could be argued to be appropriate development for Greenbelt land.
Yeah, because there are some exceptions for Greenbelt, aren't there?
Well, absolutely, and all of the criteria by which development is considered to be appropriate for Greenbelt are satisfied by a low-impact development because it does minimal harm, it enhances the environment, it provides opportunities for fresh air, it produces fresh food on the doorstep of the urban situation. I really hope that one day someone will have the money in the bottle to have a go at that one.
Yeah. Well, that's been really great. Thank you very much. You've really filled us in on a few of the technical details that we didn't really cover with Tau. But I've also been really struck by your own website before you go. Your Grow Your Own Home website, which is www.gyoh.org.uk, and is well worth having a look at. Would you like to say a bit about that?
It's essentially an enabling organisation, kind of doing perhaps much more fundamental stuff than One Planet Council. Because we don't actually have a policy to work to in England, Grow Your Own Home is essentially a vehicle to provide opportunities for people to meet each other and to learn from each other, perhaps even by bootstrapping, but we do have access to knowledge and expertise through our connections, both in England and Wales. And we've done a workshop on making community work, which was essentially about non-violent communication and consensus process in community groups. And we've done a workshop on the National Planning Policy Framework and what that and what and how that could be used to support arguments for sustainable low-impact developments. Mm. And we go out with a display, and we talk to random members of the public about low-impact development, housing opportunities. And, of course, most of them haven't got a clue what we're talking about, but we show them photographs of beautiful homes that have been built, actual real things that have been built in the UK by people with planning permission and with building regulations approval, and then say, well, you know, this little roundhouse here, anybody could build one of those from a few sticks and some this, that and the other, and that cost about £2,000 to build. And, you know, that's sort of interesting. But then you show people with other more beautiful hobbit houses that are coming out of, for example, Simon Dale's work, and they do look really lovely in the photographs. You know, well, there's a house that was built for £5,000.
Yeah.
And it gets people's attention because it challenges the paradigm. You know, beautiful hobbit house, I wish I could have one of those. Well, actually, you could.
Yeah.
all you need is the will to go for it and to take risks.
Yeah, awareness raising is so important, isn't it, when people
it
are,
is.
You know.
And the power of social media and the mainstream media in supporting Charlie and Meg's appeal against enforcement. Very photogenic couple, very photogenic house that they built, very beautiful, hundreds of thousands of people across the world supported that project.
Excellent.
Made it impossible, essentially, for the council to threaten to bulldoze it.
Wicked. I like that story. That's a good one. In fact, I think that's a really great place to finish this conversation. I think it's been really helpful. I personally, I feel a lot more optimistic about all of this, having spoken to you and Tao.
Good.
I look forward to seeing more of it happening, and thank you very, very much.
We all do.
Brilliant. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for spending some time with us, Pete. I really, really did enjoy that. And
I'm glad it's been of value. And people can come and meet us. People who are in the Hereford area for the beginning of May Bank Holiday, come and meet us at the Hereford River Carnival on Saturday the 30th of April. that's the bank holiday Saturday, and we're at Hereford River Carnival on the Bishop's Meadow, south of the river, family fun day out, and we have a stall there, and we'll be talking to people about our work. Come along.
Very good. Well, more power to your elbow and to all the people who are stepping up to the plate to make this real. I'm really grateful to all of you. And I've no doubt we'll chat again at some point. Pete, maybe we'll meet out at one of these places.
Okay. Nostar.
Nostar to you, sir. Thank you very much for being there. Cheers, matey. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Well, that was Pete the Hat giving us a bit more information on the One Planet development. It's sort of slightly more balanced after the hammering the hammering that Cotty and I gave it a couple of weeks back, and also mine and Jess's first responses to it, which were now a few weeks back. It's interesting how these things change as you kind of get in amongst them. Personally, I still have a really huge problem with the word contract in those guide notes, and I also after all this time, I'm deeply suspicious of the actual motivations behind it, but I'm nonetheless aware that some of these things can start off as one thing and become something else. I thought that last tale about people all around the world supporting one particular development, making it more or less impossible for a county council to do anything, might well be one of taking great note of. That was sounds like the power of people to me. So thanks to both of my guests there. I've got that Simon Fairley quote that Pete was mentioning from The Land, from issue 15, and it's called A View from England, Pondering the Usefulness of the One Planet, which was a good essay. And this is the closing these are the closing paragraphs which Pete was referring to. What Simon said was, what planning is supposed to do is to see that people's spatial needs are provided for without causing harm to other people or to the local or wider environment. This is a matter that requires a balancing act, weighing one impact against another. None of these impacts can be compared numerically, for if they are measurable at all, they are measured on different scales. But a decision maker, working to a combination of political and cultural values, can arrive at a decision that, yes, this development is on balance benign, and that one isn't. And it is for this reason that it is arguably easier to obtain planning permission for a low-impact community in England, where there is no dedicated policy, than in Wales, where there is one. In the absence of a policy, an inspector is free to assess an application on its own merits in relation to vague planning concepts such as low impact and sustainability, rather than against a numerical yardstick. The word low is helpfully inexact and therefore flexible. Within the context of a planning system whose main virtue is flexibility, low impact development is a more versatile concept than One Planet development, or indeed zero carbon, which, by the way, has yet to be defined by the Welsh Government. If in the near future it looks as though the Welsh Assembly is angling to ditch OPD, then bargaining for a low-impact policy instead would be a very good idea. Well, it certainly doesn't look like the Welsh Government is any longer angling to ditch OPD, and that impression may well have only been gathered because the planners themselves were so desperately unfamiliar with what was going on. And also we heard Pete put the opposite argument that in fact some people in England might choose to try and use this Welsh policy to push stuff through in England. So it's all very much at the beginning. I think there's 8 or 10 more applications of various sorts going through in Wales, which we'll be keeping an eye on through the Land magazine. And we will of course be keeping up close relations with our own local potential OPD site, which is very exciting. Though unfortunately they were told a few untruths by the people they obtained their land from, and so they had a surprise visit from the Brecon Beacons National Park Enforcement Office the other day. But it seems to have gone pretty well by and large for them, so we'll be sticking with that. And hopefully spending more time at these places. In the meantime, I think it's probably time for another tune. So, hang on a moment. Oh, lost my screen. There we go. So we'll have a Strategy from Horace X, vaguely relevant. Back with you in about 5 minutes or so. You are, of course, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com. Horace X and Strategy. I gather that Freeman Jack is once more out on the boats, struggling with raging rivers and helping out a friend. So as far as I can gather, he's probably not going to be on tonight. So stream will be free at around midnight. And I suspect this next bit's going to come as a bit of a surprise, as it kind of has to me. And I'm going to try and put a bit of background on it. The One Planet Development and several other strategy papers of one sort or another have been, as you know, drawing our detailed interest of late. And our suspicion is that what we are largely seeing is the governing mind, government, doing a bit of mind control and endeavouring to do what it normally does, which is assert control and take money. It has, again, as most of you know, made it a little difficult for Synchro and I to decide just exactly how to handle the difficulty all of this, being as we are slightly nomadic and looking to do something like is described by OPD, but without having to tell the planning department about everything we do. So the natural question arose as to what else we might get involved in. And last week I had the marvellous Greg Sams on talking to me about his State is Out of Date book, in which he basically points out that natural systems deal with complex problems much more easily than management or government or control does. That natural systems are extremely good at filling niches, creating niches and fulfilling needs. And they do this by using kind of intricate feedback loops through all stages of the process. Such things really can't be taken into account by planning policy. They need people not to be planned for, not to be managed, not to have an overseeing mind in order for them to freely adapt to situations that they find themselves in. I first read this book 3-4 years ago now, I suspect, and seemed like a very good idea, but it deliberately didn't have any practical underpinning. That wasn't Greg's intention. But recently, we found ourselves moved from looking after the loos at the Fire in the Mountain Festival to looking after organising, hosting and presenting the Festival Forum, which is obviously much more up our street. And that has involved getting becoming part of the core crew for Fire in the Mountain. And I was absolutely astonished to see what happened once that occurred, because we've been going for 3 years. It runs really well on what looked like an informal basis, but in fact it's a kind of, I guess, a modern management technique. And seeing all of the data I'm now getting, all of the open communication, I can see that everything that is said amongst the core crew is pretty much visible to the rest of the core crew. Decisions are made independently, except where those decisions actively affect somebody else, in which case advice is taken. If anybody is upset or otherwise angry, then that is addressed openly by everybody, and it all seems to run pretty smoothly. I was interested to hear that they're basing this thing on a book called Reinventing Organizations by a guy called Laloux, L-A-L-O-U-X. Now, I approach this book with a good degree of cynicism because I've read a lot of management manuals in my time, some of which have been pretty inspiring. But actually, very, very quickly got into this one, because what the man is doing is he's actually looking at a dozen companies. He examined many more, a dozen companies worldwide, some of whom just have a couple of hundred people. I think the biggest has 40,000 odd people in it. And these companies have pretty much independently just broken away from nearly all standard management techniques. They have brought one or two back in, like mentoring. But apart from that, small teams, even in a 40,000 individual company spread over the world, small teams of people are responsible for organising, hiring, firing, spending, ordering, managing, new direction, everything. And it's kind of set up so that an individual who comes up with an idea can take advice from everybody who his or her proposed spending might affect. Those people do not have the capacity to reject the person's idea or to reject the spending. If, having taken all the advice, he or she feels like spending the money, then they still will. It sounds like an entirely unlikely situation, but it's definitely happening out there, and it's arising spontaneously. And one of the first things these companies have, a bit like the OPD people when I was talking with Tao, is is effective dispute resolution systems, which I think is completely vital. This sort of openness of data, openness of communication for everybody on the entire team to be as equally empowered as everybody else and to have some means of sorting this out which works is totally crucial for any projects that we're going to be lining ourselves up with over the next couple of years, or, you know, even immediately, really. Now, as a result of learning all of this, I've been kind of examining the projects that I'm involved in, and several of them have looked a bit shaky. Some of them have gone. One of them that I thought was absolutely dead in the water, because frankly its communication has been absolutely execrable over the years, and I really didn't think it was anywhere near close enough to a benchmark to even get started, last weekend suddenly revealed itself to have transformed into one of these kind of alternative organisations. One individual, who is I think a project planner in real life, got hold of a piece of project planning software and outlined all of the original aims of this group that I'm thinking of and broke it all down into various jobs, all of which are now visible to every single member of this particular group. All of the data, all of it, and people can put their names in, they can say how long it's going to take, they can see other people's diaries. It is now gone from being something about which none of us knew anything or heard anything for 5 years to being something which, if people really want this to work, they can now effectively step up to the plate. And I've concluded that, really, given the state of things, I do need to be actually concentrating on projects that basically work in such an open, cooperative and community spirit where everybody understands what's going on and everybody effectively is equally empowered to do something about it. As an ex-manager and an agent for growth, change and improvement, this I find really exciting. Actually, it's the first thing that's properly engaged me in a positive sense for quite a while. And this is inevitably going to involve a bit of rearranging at the surgery. And part of this would appear to involve ceasing to broadcast on people's internet radio, which has taken me a fair amount of time to conclude, but it is unfortunately the way I work. I do tend to look around and eventually change. Time for change comes, and I think that the time for me has come to change a bit. I'm, as you can tell, a bit shaky about it, but I'm really grateful to everybody at PIR for all of the years I've spent there broadcasting, and to everybody that's been listening and joining in. I'm still going to be in the chat listening as a listener, hopefully, to excellent output that comes from this station. I guess that's it, really. Like I say, bit of a surprise to me, I'm sure, pretty much a shock to you as well. 201 shows, and I guess signing off. A lot of love and gratitude to you all. Of course, all contacts are welcome. dr.dr.rock2012 on Skype, and all change. I'll be seeing you, folks. I'm going to play out with Screaming Miss Jackson and the inevitable Motorhead. See you in the chat, folks.